Okay. So that's helpful. So I'll talk about first the state of the art in terahertz direct detectors. So, for example, bolometers. And this is defined by the needs of astrophysics. And then also terahertz amplifiers. So, yeah, amplifiers and mixers. And I think probably, as most of you know, direct detectors, in principle, there's no quantum limit. You can, in principle, detect an arbitrarily small number of photons. You can count photons. The photon multiplier tube is sort of the ideal. Direct detector for us, for small photon fluxes. And if you have an amplifier or a mixer, then quantum mechanics imposes a fundamental limit on the sensitivity, because basically there's no such thing as a noiseless amplifier or a noiseless mixer. And this is because you're keeping track of both the amplitude and the phase of the light in the case of an amplifier or a mixer. And so the uncertainty principle means that you can't have a noiseless detector. In the case of a direct detector, you're throwing out all the information about the phase. So for astrophysics, various types of bolometers are the sort of detectors of choice that people are using for extragalactic astrophysics. And in the terahertz frequency range, there are other people who are much more expert about this than I, but if you look at sort of power as a function of frequency, you have the cosmic microwave background, which has its peak at about 100 gigahertz, and then there's dust that peaks at somewhat higher frequencies. And because there's such a large number of photons per mode, a photon counting detector is actually not necessary and not useful, really, in astrophysics. So the kind of figure of merit that people use for detectors like this is the NEP, noise equivalent power. That's the power you can detect with a signal-to-noise ratio of 1. And there's sort of 10 to the minus 20 watts per root hertz, roughly, is getting you within a factor of the photon noise limit for astrophysics. Now, this isn't good enough for what you guys want to do. Well, you could do better. I mean, okay, I'm saying you might be able to do well.
Much better.
You would want to be able to do much better, whereas for astrophysics, it doesn't pay to do much better. So I would say that the lack of a demand for a photon counting terahertz detector for any application has sort of stunted research in this area. And if you guys have a compelling need for such a detector, then there are lots of people who would love to work on it. Yeah?
Can you say how these bolometers work?
Yeah. A bolometer is just, they're typically, well, they're different kinds of bolometers. So there are composite bolometers where you have a substrate that absorbs a photon, and then a thermistor that measures the change in temperature. So you absorb a photon and you measure the change in temperature. The name of the game is to reduce the, you want to have sort of absorb as much as you can with minimal heat capacity. And people have done these very beautiful things like making spider web bolometers where they make sort of a spider web like structure that supports the thermistor. And so the spider web, because there are a lot of holes in it, it has very low heat capacity. But if it's appropriately metallized, it can still absorb the radiation. So if you want a single detector, people do this. Now, people have been moving now more to what are called transition edge sensors, which are using a superconductor. So this is a composite bolometer.
What temperature do you have to run those at?
Those are sort of, I think 100 millikelvin is where people run them. In principle, the heat capacity goes, well, heat capacity associated with phonons goes like T cubed. Heat capacity associated with electrons goes like T. So you win there, and also in terms of having a low heat capacity and also in having low thermal noise by going to.
How big are these things?
The wavelengths are sort of millimeter. So that's typical scale.
And the noise equivalent power must scale with area, right?
No, the noise equivalent power, so there's another figure of merit that scales with area, which is called the detectivity. So D star is, the units of D star are, remember, Nick?
Just 1/NEP and divided by the area.
Yeah, so.
Per unit area, that's 1/that.
Okay. Isn't it the square root of the area?
Yeah, square root of the area. So it should be like a centimeter there.
But what you usually end up doing is coupling your detector to some device that is coupling in a single mode of the electromagnetic field. So if you're coupling to a single mode of the electromagnetic field, then this is the more relevant figure of merit. If you have, say, a photoconductor that is coupling to many modes of the electromagnetic field, then this is the more relevant figure of merit.
Why is there, can you explain to me a bit more about these stars? So scales like the area to the 1/2, so the linear size of the setup. So it grows, why does it grow linearly with the size?
Yeah, just noise grows linearly with the size.
So Yeah, so...
What's the proportion to the noise equivalent power? The noise equivalent power multiply the size if you grow linearly? I mean, why is it the ratio?
Oh, D star, so with any P, small is good. With D star, big is good. But, so...
Okay. It's inversely proportional to the noise equivalent power. That's fine.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's
yeah.
inversely proportional to the length.
Okay, so if you have, imagine a photoconductor. Then in a photoconductor, you have always some dark current.
Is it? Okay, continue.
You have some dark current, and the dark current scales. So the noise associated with the dark current scales like the square root of the dark current. That's the shot noise associated with the dark current. And so the... So as you make the detector bigger, you win in your sensitivity.
Because the dark current goes down.
The dark current goes up as you make it bigger.
Because the dark current goes like the area.
Dark current goes like the area.
You can also look at the
detector. Oh, okay. It's just the square of the number of measurements.
So the noise of the detector.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. What type of efficiency can you get, like, at those frequencies?
Yeah, well, with a photoconductor, you can get essentially close to, probably 80% or something, depending on, if you anti-reflection coat it, you can get close to 100%. I think with this, it's about 50%.
But what would be the range of terahertz?
Okay, so I was told yesterday that they're interested in looking for 100 gigahertz to 100 terahertz.
It's unknown. It would be, the dark matter mass, which is unknown.
The range,
whatever you can do, and right now there's...
Don't want a single detector that covers the whole range.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. But this is the if you can bring a single photon counter in any one of these frequencies, we would be happy.
No, 100 terahertz, it's not a problem.
Below 100 gigahertz,
Okay. So they're bolometers, they're photoconductors, which you would probably go for if you were going above a couple of terahertz. A photoconductor is a very nice option. In a photoconductor, you have, some impurities in a semiconductor. So this is real space, some impurities. And if I look at if they're donors, then they're some distance below the band gap. And if you go very cold, then if the photons are sort of above the threshold for kicking an electron out of its bound state, then you can get a very high quantum efficiency detector. I don't know that. I mean, people haven't tried to make photoconductors detect single photons, to my knowledge, but I don't understand why, in principle, you couldn't.
This is just a doped material?
It's just a piece of doped semiconductor.
Okay.
And you can detect the single electrons? That's
not... Well, yeah, it's not... There's no... I mean, there is something called photoconductive gain, but it's not very big. So detecting the single electrons is not easy.
But in principle,
how do you detect them?
Oh, I mean, in a photoconductor, what you do is you put the photoconductor into what's called a transimpedance amplifier. See, how does this work? Very, very, very high. So you have so you have a bias on here. You have this is a virtual ground. So the photon comes in, creates a current, and then that current gets amplified, and you detect. So there's not really any carrier multiplication, which is what you would really like. I mean, there can be a little bit, but
and this is also highly efficient, single photon efficient.
I am not aware of anyone who has detected single photons based on photoconductors, but.
But in principle, if you will apply the field for the shallow donor detector, you can actually multiply them.
Yeah. But it's possible that.
So it's been done with optical photons, and which is very easy. The challenge, of course, is the dark rate is enormous for millennia. Though, if you can get it cold enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think people have really looked, well, to my knowledge, people have not looked at photoconductors at, say, 50 millikelvin, where there should be essentially no dark current.
I remember back in Sears lab, they actually made dilution fridge with a bolometer, but it was useless for their applications because, of course, it was extremely sensitive. It's more sensitive than any other bolometer possible. But it was so non-linear that for spectroscopy, it was useless. But it is possible to put it in a dilution fridge and
yeah, very
sensitive.
So this would be worth probably looking at. And so there are a wide variety of photoconductors. And you've got germanium. And then depending, you know, germanium is a group 4 element in the periodic table. So you've got carbon, silicon, germanium. And so then you can dope germanium, either p-type by putting in something from column 3 or n-type, means something from column 5. And each donor has a somewhat different energy, acceptor energy. And then silicon also. So germanium, If you do, say, gallium and germanium, gallium is an acceptor, and that's about 10 MeV is the Rydberg, the ionization energy of that. For phosphorus and silicon, it's more like, I don't know, 40 MeV. And there are some detectors based on these photoconductors that have flown on missions like the infrared astronomy mission, and they actually made arrays of these detectors.
So the idea is that there's electrons bound to these, or holes bound to these impurities with a gap of 10 milliev or so.
Yeah.
So when a photon hits it, you excite one in the conduction band, and you can look for that, the current caused by
that. Yeah. But, you know, so what you really would want, though, is some kind of multiplication, electron multiplication, ideally, if you really want to count electrons, count photons.
Why not couple it to a single electron transistor and measure a tiny current? Is it too high frequency, an RF set? I don't know. I mean, it may be too high a frequency for it.
Yeah, no, that's not crazy. You might be able to couple it to a single electron transistor. So somehow replace this with an RF set. It's possible. There always are going to be some kind of sort of fluctuating noise issues.
Not thermally though, right?
Yeah.
No, not thermally. I'm just, yeah, not thermally. I guess if you're really very cold and you have a very pure material, then you should have zero current. And then when you excite one electron, it's possible. It's just the electron has to go places. I mean, it's not like right on the set.
The doped material is the actual the gate material, is the doped material for like you were drawing yesterday. So basically you use it as a component of the set itself.
I think you would need, if you want to, so the absorption cross section of a donor and gallium arsenide. Mm-hmm. So of a donor and gallium arsenide, I think the absorption cross is something like 10 to the minus 12 per square centimeter for a photon. So if you want to get a high probability absorption, you need to have a lot of these.
Of these materials.
Of these.
Okay. It doesn't work.
I think it's.
What about?
I have a more promising candidate.
Okay.
But
you were saying.
Go ahead.
Comfort is a spider web.
Yeah.
this is what you wanted to...
No, that's not the more promising candidate.
That's a significant cross-section, and the thermometer, if you, it's really a temperature jump, will be probably measurable for a single photon, if you go to microkelvins.
Micro?
Yes.
Micro?
Yeah, dilution fridge.
No, dilution fridge is millikelvins.
Yeah, millikelvins. Okay.
Millikelvins. At 1 millikelvin.
It's still 1 million times more sensitive than at 100 millikelvin.
Well, that's only if the heat capacity is dominated by phonons, and it's going to be dominated by electrons at that point.
But what were you saying about the absorption cross-section?
But you can't have like 12
square centimeters per impurity.
Per impurity. So you need a density of something like 10^12 per square centimeter.
Right.
Integrated.
Yeah, is that unreasonable or?
No. Okay. So let's say we had. So if we had, say, a detector that was 1 millimeter cubed, then then you would want, you want to keep the concentration of impurities pretty low. But if you had, say, 1 millimeter cubed, and I needed to have 10^12 per centimeter squared, then that would correspond to so what density would that translate to?
It's 10^10 per millimeter squared. Oh, you mean density, like
what's the 3D density that corresponds to? That's 10^15.
Is it millimeter in size?
Yeah, let's say millimeter is a typical size.
It's about 10^14, I think, per centimeter cube.
It's 10^10 per cubic millimeter. If it's a millimeter cube.
Okay.
If it's a millimeter cubed, you need 10^10 per cubic millimeter to have a projected.
10^10 per cubic. Millimeter, so that's 10^13 per cubic centimeter, just so I can calibrate.
Yeah, 10^13.
Okay, yeah, so that's a very, it's a state-of-the-art material you can get with that.
You could make it thicker, too.
The problem is then, but if it becomes bigger, so, coupling to a set is impossible, right?
Right, that was my point, is that it's yeah, I mean, I think it's...
the set is too small, you have impedance function problems, basically.
I mean, you could couple this to the gate of a single electron transistor, but...
this is too big for a set.
Yeah, I don't have a... need to work out the numbers in terms of the capacitance.
Yeah.
What kind of change in voltage would result?
Because we're working in units of 8 pi and c equals to 1. In those units, capacitance and inductance have units of length. So then 1 meter is 1 picofarad. So you make one something smaller, 1 millimeter, then it's 10^15 farad, that's the -15 farads.
Okay.
So that gives you size of the capacitance. And so typical set capacitances are about, because they are, 100 microns in size, so they're between 10^-16 and -10^-17 farad. The problem is now, because we're looking at terahertz, frequencies, this is not in a regime where you can treat it as a circuit, because the circuit is not, if you have a millimeter size object at those frequencies, then the light crossing time is longer than from 10 to the minus 12 seconds.
But here we're not looking at a current that's oscillating at terahertz, right? We're looking at one electron that's dislodged.
Yes, but the problem is I don't know how to treat this as a circuit, right? Because the point is that if you have a millimeter at that
Well, no, you. I mean, you just treat this as a... The terahertz is
the terahertz is just enough to
it's just getting absorbed.
It's a DC current. I mean, there might be subtleties.
Yes, this is what I'm thinking about. There is time.
You guys want to come work in my lab? Okay, so I'd say there's a question mark about coupling. But I wouldn't rule it out.
No, I mean, there may be some suppression, but it may be fine, actually, because, anyway.
So another option may be an avalanche layer. But so suppose you actually could get single photon counting. If it's a DC signal, all you're really doing is asking whether or not you have, you're measuring your dark rate. What else can you? What can you vary? What variation goes with the signal that would allow us to tell that whatever single electron signals you get coming out are not just noise?
Oh, sometimes, for example, in this toy setup, so the signal that you get is has an energy. This terahertz would be given by the mass of the dark matter particle. So it would be a monochromatic source. So for example, you can tune that cavity to have a mode tuned to the dark matter mass. And if you change the cavity mode by one part per million in energy, then you would be off resonance and you would not have a signal.
I see. Okay.
So for a lot of the dark matter signals, you can change the setup. Not necessarily the photodetector itself, but the absorbing volume. To go on and off resonance. There's tunability.
Good. So then even if you do have a single electron noise from dark current or whatever else, it only gets in the way of your signal in terms of its fluctuations.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You can look at signals below the dark current because you can go on and off resonance.
But there should be essentially zero dark current in a properly made device that.
You always some calls.
I mean, you could put in a calibrated photon source, a terahertz photon source that would give you one terahertz photon per second absorbed, and because turn it on and turn it off to make sure that you.
Deep on the ground, there still will be neutrinos.
So that's why we need to do coincidence measurements. You probably it's not going to be the only detector in the experiment, so probably you need a scintillator material to know that you have high radioactivity, and you have to do time correlated measurements. So if you see something at the energy and you see something else at the same time at some other energy, then it's not the dark matter that you want, the signal that you want. So this makes it easy. By the way, this is true for absorption experiments that we're talking about. For scattering experiments, if you have the usual direct detection experiments, that requires a bit more thinking, which we have not done to tell you
how. It's harder to shut that signal off.
Yeah.
Okay.
This one we can shut off.
Yeah. But the cosmic rays and radioactivity, you can try to veto.
Yes, that doesn't sound right. Oh, yeah.
Relatively.
Okay, but Mark, so a key thing which I guess is obvious, but I missed it, is that you can get cold enough that you can just turn off the dark current.
Yeah.
Okay, because you can go well below the threshold.
Yeah, the threshold is 10 millivolts, so okay. You go to 50 millikelvin, yeah, you turn off the dark current. Okay, so I think amplifiers are, and coherent detectors, the quantum limit is h nu over k. So at 10 millivolts, the quantum limit is something like 100 Kelvin, which is 10 to the minus 21 watts per hertz. It's different figure of merit. And the state of the art is 5 to 10 times worse than the quantum limit at above a terahertz. People are approaching the quantum limit between 100 gigahertz and maybe up to a few hundred gigahertz. So so there are superconductor, insulator superconductor mixers, and those are nearly quantum limited. Up to, I think, about 300 gigahertz, give or take. And that is, and that will, it's hard to make that go above a terahertz. And then there are superconducting hot electron bolometers. And they're about 5 to 10 times the quantum limit for 1 to 5 terahertz. So I don't think these are so promising. So, if you want to detect a photon every once in a while, a single photon, a mixer is, unless there's something that I'm not understanding. Although as I understand it, the experiments that you were talking about at 10 gigahertz are using amplifiers. I think they could be using. Okay. Okay, because it's single. Because at 10 gigahertz, I would think. I mean, people who are doing quantum information science can do single photon. Yeah. So. There is one paper that I sent around to Nathaniel, and he forwarded, which is a very beautiful paper from the late, from 2000. And this is by a Japanese group. And they demonstrated real terahertz photon counting. So what they have is a quantum dot. So okay, so these are gates. And this is a 2D electron gas in gallium arsenide. It's in a magnetic field. And the they're running a current through the device, and it's at dilution refrigerator temperature. So they're in this regime of the so-called Coulomb blockade, and so in this Coulomb blockade regime, if you look at the conductance as a function of this gate voltage. Let's see. Peaks corresponding each peak is associated with adding another electron onto this device. So the current is essentially zero here, and it's high, or it's easily measurable when you're on the peak. And so what they so electron in a magnetic field is the energy spectrum gets defined by the band breaks up into what are called Landau levels. So if I look at the energy of so the electrons are undergoing cyclotron motion. So if I look as a function of magnetic field at the energy level, I have what's called a Landau fan. So in a Landau level, the energy of in the nth state is h bar times the cyclotron frequency times n plus a half, where this cyclotron frequency is Eb over effective mass. So to give you a sense of scale, for in gallium arsenide, effective mass is 1/15 of the electron mass. In silicon, M star is, I think, about the electron mass. And then there are other semiconductors like indium antimonide where M star is something like M naught over 50. So in gallium arsenide, this works out to be that the cyclotron frequency, so this has a 2 pi in it, cyclotron frequency is about 420 gigahertz per Tesla. Now you also have cyclotron levels in graphene. Graphene is a little different and more complicated, but I just talked to Andrea Young before I came over. In graphene, it's 36 millivolts times the square root of the magnetic field is the transition between the zeroth and the first Landau level. Tesla. So inside this quantum dot, if we look at the energy as a function of position along this coordinate,
the effective mass in graphene?
No. The effective mass, graphene doesn't have an effective mass. Graphene is a relativistic. So this should be h bar omega c.
The
energy of the cyclotron.
For which n?
Oh, yeah, so that's for.
Okay, sorry, got it.
For
got
0 to 1.
Omega c.
Yeah, and it's also possible to get minus 1 to 1 transition, but we'd have to ask Andrea for, this is all well known, it's just not at my fingertips. But I guess there's it's easy to get into this frequency range with cyclotron resonance. So if this is the, say, the center of the quantum dot, then they've tuned the density so that the first Landau level is filled and the second Landau level is empty. So when a terahertz photon comes in to this quantum dot, it goes up into the second Landau level and then it quickly relaxes to the middle of the quantum dot. And that changes the charge distribution in the quantum, and it stays there for a long time. I mean, the lifetime can be fractions of a second. And that changes the capacitance of the quantum dot, which can move you from off the SET, off the conductance peak to on the conductance peak. And so they see very clearly sort of a telegraph-like signal associated with the when they're shining a very weak terahertz source, which they actually make by running current through a similar device that tends to emit at this frequency. So they have kind of a transceiver set up in their cryostat, they're just sort of spraying terahertz photons on this, and they didn't put an antenna or anything on this. They're just sort of spraying photons on it, and a few of them get absorbed. And when one gets absorbed, then the current goes from either on to off or off.
And that's because they knew the capacitance jump out of time, so they tune their gain voltage,
so they jump the right amount. They have a graph that shows it as a function of gate voltage, and so.
I guess they could work it out.
Yeah.
The lifetime is long. You just sweep it repeatedly, right?
Yeah, and they.
That's what they're doing.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I think this is a very beautiful paper that, and they're getting photoconductive. Well, they're getting between, they say, 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 12 electrons per photon, depending on
from the conductance.
So it's a huge photoconductive gain that they're getting out of this. Now, there's
how often were they seeing? How often were they seeing the signal?
Depend on the intensity that they were shining. The coupling was tiny. Coupling efficiency was tiny, but they're just spraying so many photons that every once in a while some of them lands on it. It's easy to make terahertz. I mean, it's easy to make terahertz photons. It's hard to not make them.
So how hard would it be to try to couple this to an antenna or something?
Yeah. Okay, so when I was talking to you guys yesterday, I was concerned about that. But there's a subsequent paper that is just from a few years ago. So it's Applied Physics Letter
1%.
They estimate that the quantum yield is about 1% for
photons that fall on the electric column. 1%. Okay. Because they don't have an antenna.
Yeah.
Pretty
good for this.
Yeah. Well, it says, I can read it to you, it says the incident flux on the effective antenna area.
That's about the size of the object.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't look at that carefully. It's one of the things I like about this paper, that they're quite cautious about what they claim. The point of this paper was they didn't optimize the coupling at all.
This would have tiny dark cards, I guess, right?
Well, when they... yeah, that varies, but they talk about that, and I think they quote some lower limit to the dark signal in terms of the switch rate was as small as 0.001 per second.
So 1 per 1,000.
Yeah. So then the next question is, how do you actually, if you want to use this as a detector, how do you couple it efficiently to a detector? And so this paper, so these guys cite conversations with this guy, but they worked independently, but also in Japan. And they claim that, so they made a transmission line and they had an emitter here which was something like one of these, and then they had a detect, and then they had one of these over here, and they coupled between them with a transmission line. And they claim that they're getting that they're getting 80% coupling from the emitter into the transmission line and 80% coupling from the transmission line into the device. And they actually calculated the impedance of the device and it was tens of ohms, which and yesterday when we were talking, I was saying the problem, there's a difficulty coupling to these mesoscopic devices, that typical impedances are tens of kiloohms. But because there's this resonant enhancement, that would be the impedance, I think. I haven't worked through this, but I think that's the impedance on resonance. You get this huge resonant enhancement. So they're claiming sort of a tens of ohm impedance for the device on resonance, which couples. So they're claiming sort of 80% from here to the transmission line, and then 80% from the transmission line to the SET. So they may have...
Same Coulomb blockade.
It's using the Coulomb blockade, but now they're...
The transmission line is to get the amplified current out?
No, sorry. The transmission line is to get the photons in.
Yeah. Oh.
So they've basically coupled this to some kind of a transmission line.
What is the photon rate that they found? Do they...
Yeah, I didn't actually have a chance. I just found this paper this morning, so I didn't have a chance to look at it carefully, and it's rather involved. But
how big are these, actually? How big is the collection area in that?
Oh, the single electron transistor.
On the second... on the first paper or the second paper, how big?
These are a few hundred nanometers.
So in the second area, the collection area is how big? So it's 100 nanometers?
A few hundred nanometers. But, if you can couple with a transmission line, then that means you can put an antenna
and make it
on the transmission line to couple from free space into the antenna. So, I mean, their paper is motivated by kind of quantum communication, quantum information. But I feel like the fact that, you know, you can tolerate or maybe even want a magnetic field, and you're operating in this completely dark environment, it's like a perfect, I mean, it seems like a perfect match between this kind of technology and what you guys are interested in. Yeah.
So I remember, like, in that paper, like, they talk about there, like, they can do some, like, 100 to, like, maybe, like, 170 something, like, micron, like, wavelengths. It's like, is it, like, how easy would it be, like, to extend that range?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's to zeroth order, you just need to sweep the magnetic field. And you would need to tune the charge density also to maintain, because as you change the magnetic field, you're changing the spacing between the Landau levels, so you would want to tune the charge density.
So it's not really like you are sitting at a sweet spot. You can get like the same type of sensitivity to like a much wider frequency.
I think so. I'd have to look at the numbers, but I don't see why you couldn't.
That's the charge density of the too much electron gas was, so you gate the sample of how tunable. I mean, practically speaking, I don't have to go about the different dots and different inner structures, right? I can. How yes.
Yeah. I mean, you probably don't want to go much below 10 to the 10 per square centimeter, but you might be able to make this work. You might be able to make this work, you know, using a higher Landau level. So,
transition edge.
So the transition edge sensors rely on the fact that the resistance is a function of temperature of a superconductor, has a very sharp change at the critical temperature of the superconductor. And so these can have, I believe, so the basic idea is that you have a bolometer, but it's made out of a piece of superconductor, and you absorb a photon, and then the change in temperature moves you up and down on this curve.
The performance of these compared to the other bolometers?
They're sort of similar. Easier to make into arrays because they can use SQUID multiplexing, superconducting quantum interference device multiplexing, to read them out. Ben knows all about that. Ben Mazin. But it's possible to read out multiple detectors on a single.
So Ben Mazin was telling us last week that you often have these non-thermal populations of quasi-particles that they give you an effective noise in things like MKIDs and PESs. Do you have the same for quantum dots, for example? Is that a concern? Are there excitations, like non-thermal excitations, that can give you dark noise?
Well, we don't have a condensate. I don't. So that physics is different. There isn't. there isn't that much data. I know it's not easy to get electrons to thermalize. You have to wait for a long time. But I haven't heard about non-thermal excitations in these types of systems, but it's a very small literature, I think.
This is great. This is very useful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions?